the lecture on quantum measurement, which I intended to try to get through last week, but we've got about half a lecture still to work through. So the idea here was that, let's skip by that. We wanted to think about von Neumann's model for quantum measurement and see, you know, what aspects of quantum measurement we can reproduce. What is the range of types of measurement that we can fit within our framework when we attempt to look at quantum measurement through the machinery of the general quantum operations framework that we developed in the last couple of lectures. So the idea in von Neumann's model is to say we can consider a model for measurement as coupling with an environment that we now consider to be the meter system, the thing that's doing the measurement. There's some sort of coupling of the system with the environment. That environment's in an initial state that is known. And then we conclude the process by doing a measurement on the environment. And because of the coupling that induced correlations between the system and environment, we've learned something about the system.
Really solve anything? Because, like, you just moved the whole weirdness of predictive measurements to the environment.
So here's what it gives you, and then I'll tell you about what it doesn't. What it gives you is a much broader understanding of what is the range of types of measurements we can do. You could say, how can I construct a measurement model that lets me measure things in this particular way? So these ideas of weak measurement and so on are going to find a natural home in this language. And in fact, all measurements of the forms of POVMs can be written in this form of coupling to some sort of meter as an environment and then performing a regular projective measurement on that environment. So if you decided you want to have a set of axioms that were based around the unitary coupling of system environment and only projective measurements, then you could get the full range of measurements given by POVMs out of this framework. So that's useful. That's what it gives you. It gives you a better understanding of what you might do. And this has turned out to be actually very powerful for the quantum experimentalists who were trying to figure out how to very carefully interrogate their system with some known properties of something that's a quantum meter. But then we're going to look today at what it doesn't give you, how it doesn't, as you say, really solve the problem. It's just kicking the can down the road a bit. In terms of understanding the relationship between measurement, which is a non-unitary process, it doesn't follow the constraints of having a nice convex linear CPTP map that describes it, and we'll see exactly why that is. Okay, so we constructed a measurement model along the lines of von Neumann, but now we've focused on using a finite dimensional system in order to just push aside a lot of the problems associated with position eigenstates and things like that. Okay, so we now call our environment a measurement qubit. We're going to initialize it in some particular state. We're going to couple the system with the environment using this C0 unitary, which sets the basis, the observable that we're trying to measure on the system. We're trying to measure properties of the Pauli spin in the z-axis. And this is a coupling with the environment that correlates the spin of the system and the z component of its spin with that of the meter. And then we're going to conclude that with measuring this measurement qubit in a particular basis. Okay, we can set all that within the framework of our generalized quantum operations, our CPTP maps, in particular our operator sum representation, as follows. But remember the key difference between the operator sum representation for a quantum operation and a measurement. The operator sum representation may pick a basis for the environment to trace over at the end, but nonetheless, it is discarding the environment. It is just tracing over it. It doesn't give a measurement outcome. Whereas when we want to do a measurement, we're going to measure the meter, we're going to learn something about it, and we're going to pick out a particular element of that measurement basis as saying this element, this outcome occurred. And that distinction may look quite innocuous and mild, but we're going to highlight just how odd it is. Okay, but nonetheless, we can describe the first parts, the coupling with the environment, within this operator sum language. So here we have the initial state of the environment, the unitary that couples the system to the environment, and then a basis for the environment. That is now the basis we're going to measure it in. That gives me a pair of operators that we would have called in the last lecture E sub 0 and E sub 1 that we use to construct an operator sum representation as follows for the map. If we had traced over the environment, well, we would just pick a basis to do that trace, and we would find this map. This is as if we didn't measure the environment, but we just subsequently ignored it and says, what happens to the system? Where the only difference now is I've called these E operators M. But they still satisfy all the conditions of that operator sum representation. However, we say that's not quite what we're doing. We're not just picking any basis to trace over. We're actually going to measure in this basis. So not only does that give us a preferred set of operators for the operator sum representation, because we say this is the basis that I'm going to measure my environment in, whereas normally we'd have a degree of freedom, a unitary degree of freedom in being able to change that basis and change those operators. So not only do we get that, but we say that in measuring the environment, we now invoke our different postulate of quantum mechanics. We say we're not just tracing over it, describing it by a convex linear map. We're now going to pick out one of those outcomes, either m equals 0 or m equals 1. That picks out a particular term in this convex combination, that is the operator sum representation. And we have to renormalize our state. That makes it this process of picking one and going to it not any longer convex linear. We say that one of them occurs with some probability, the other occurs with a different probability. And here we really do now interpret these M's as measurement operators on the system. We've done a measurement on a system described by some measurement operators M, from which I can form a POVM that describes that measurement, and it predicts, using the Born rule, these right probabilities for measurement on the system. So that is, in some sense, satisfying. You say, well, this framework of the operator sum representation just has to be expanded a bit by just including this one step. Picking a preferred basis, that's the one we measure the environment in, and then having a map that goes either to this state or this state, depending on the outcome, which is just randomly chosen with some probability. So what we're mostly going to explore today is, in one part, the range of different types of maps that these measurements can be. In this example, we'll show how we can learn a small amount or a large amount about the system by varying the various parameters describing our measurement qubit. And we'll also look into how exactly do we describe this non-convex linear step of the map. It has some odd properties. Okay. So any questions on what we're doing there? Does that sound good? Okay, so the first thing I want to do is, we're going to call it weak measurements. We're going to show that we can not only do, but through this coupling with the measurement qubit and a particular measurement on the measurement qubit, not only can we induce a projective measurement in the Z basis on the system qubit, but we can, in fact, have a measurement that the measurement result is only partially correlated with the state of the qubit. It only provides us some information, but it also doesn't completely disturb the state of that system. So you only get sort of partial wave function collapse in that process. So let's look at what I mean by that, because that sounds a bit strange. Let's choose some particular parameters. Basically, I want to choose 8 equals 0 because I want, you notice back here, I had in my measurement operator something that depended on the cosines and sines of the difference of these two angles and trig functions of the sum. I want to make those things the same. That's just a restriction that gives me a bit more of a balanced measurement. We basically do this by having 8 equals 0, but I'm going to rename then chi gamma. There's now a single parameter for our measurements. Our measurement operators are cos gamma Our measurement operators satisfy that relation. Okay, this just turns out to balance the two types of probability. So it's a weak but nonetheless balanced measurement. Okay, so let's consider some special cases. If we chose this gamma to equal to 0, let's see that what we get is a projective measurement on the system qubit. Well, it's pretty clear that my measurement operators are m naught is projection onto the 0 state, m1 is projection onto the 1 state. The probability associated with getting 0 is going to be, well, here I can write it for both terms. The probability of getting outcome m for m equals 0 or 1 is m rho s m, just like the Born rule predicts. And the post-measurement state, after I get outcome m, the system is left in the state m, just as you would expect from a projective measurement, following the Luders rule update that we mentioned last time. So here we'll just note that the final state is an eigenvector of the measurement. Regardless of the input, so we've learned a lot about the system, but we also have sort of over a range that we're going to explore a maximum disturbance of the system. In this case, we have a wave function collapse, which completely eliminates any information about what that initial state is, and now just leaves me in an outcome given by the measurement result. Okay, so that's sort of the most extreme example where you can see that final selection of that outcome is a not convex linear map. Let's consider the other extreme. Let's pick that angle to be pi on 4. And in this case, what we're going to do, we have no measurement done at all. What does that even mean? Well, in the operator sum representation, I find that both those measurement operators are proportional to the identity. The probability of the two measurement outcomes, either of the measurement outcomes, is a half. And the final state of the system, regardless of measurement outcome, is equal to, the initial state, rho. So in this case, our measurement outcome is completely uncorrelated with the system. We haven't learned anything by measuring the qubit state of the measurement device. It had the same coupling as before, but we've chosen to measure on a basis that tells us nothing about that correlation. So we haven't learned anything, but we also haven't disturbed anything. So this idea of disturbance, sometimes people call it back action. In the first case, when we did a projective measurement on a system, the system state at the end is completely uncorrelated with what it was before. We've maximally disturbed it. We have a huge kick on the system. People might say a large back action in that case due to the measurement. Whereas in a second example where we've, in a sense, dialed the measurement down to zero, now it's not telling us anything about the system. We've learned nothing, but we haven't disturbed the system at all. Now, of course, we can do things in between. So we call things in the range. The unit, so this is an interesting thing about this mapping is the unitary is fixed. We're always coupling with a with the same unitary, the system and the measurement. What we're doing is just, in a sense, measuring the wrong thing about the meter. It's telling us nothing about the system, and it's not obvious then that just because you didn't learn anything about the system doesn't mean you didn't disturb it, but you can follow through the steps of that example and show, yeah, it didn't disturb it at all. Both those operators in the operator sum decomposition corresponding to 0 or 1 are both proportional to the identity. They don't disturb the system. Okay, so let's now consider things strictly in this range. And we call these weak measurements. Of course, that can be arbitrarily strong, but it's still called weak if it's not projective. OK, so now we have general measurement operators as given at the top. We can work out what are the probabilities associated with measurements. Here it's a little trickier to write them in a common form without overburdening the notation, so I'll write it out explicitly. So what we can see in this example, while we sort of think through, if the result, if the initial state of the system were in zero, well, we don't always still get the outcome 0. We only get it with probability cos squared gamma. Sometimes we get the outcome 1. If the system was in the state 1, we don't always get the outcome 1. Sometimes we get the outcome 0. But if gamma is closer to 0 than to pi on 4, then it's more likely, given the state 0, that you'll get the outcome 0 than 1. And it's more likely, given the state 1, you'll get the outcome 1 rather than 0. So we're learning some information. The measurement result is partially correlated with the initial state of the system. With rho s. And now let's think about the disturbance. Well, here it's a bit more complicated. So I'm going to write out the general expression. What would be the resulting state after measurement of some initial rho s, given the outcome, we got the outcome 0? Well, using our rules from the previous page, this is 1 over the probability of getting 0. That's just renormalizing the state. M naught rho s M naught dagger. So that is, if we were to write it out, we got to apply this operator on the left and a similar operator on the right. OK, what's not obvious from this expression is, you know, what's happening, that there's really a partial disturbance in the system. So let's actually focus down on a couple of special cases that will help us out. OK, so let me go here. So we have, OK, let's consider two cases. Let's consider the first case where the system is with some probability in the state 0, say with probability q, and otherwise it's in the state 1. And there's no coherence here. This is a mixed state, yes?
Were you assuming that there was no coherence in the former slide?
No, no, I'm working on an example, sorry.
Hey, yeah, yeah. In the former slide, because you didn't have any cross terms, why didn't you have any cross terms?
Oh, here, so this can be coherent. The measurement operators are diagonal. They have no cross terms. That's just reflecting of the fact that we're measuring in the spaces.
In the middle of the board, there's like row 0 is the sum of only two terms. There's no cross terms there. Why are there no cross terms?
Sorry, what equation are you pointing to? The probabilities here?
Yeah.
So this is just the given these diagonal measurement operators and therefore a diagonal POVM, for any row, it will only depend on those diagonal elements. So the diagonalness is coming from the measurement, not from the state. The state is arbitrary. So it's perhaps because if you're thinking of if I was trying to describe a projective measurement, that would not be the case. I could not, you know, just have it go into that diagonal form. But it's not a projective measurement in this case. It's a convex sum of two terms which are both diagonal in the Z basis. Okay, so it's the measurement operators in a POVM which is diagonal, not the state. Is that okay? Okay, so let's work out this example where the state is also diagonal. Okay, so let's consider getting the outcome 0. Well, how often does that occur? That occurs with probability q cos squared gamma plus 1 minus q sine squared gamma. How do I interpret that? Well, I had an initial state, which with some probability is in the state 0, probability q, otherwise it's in 1. And then I do a measurement that is weak. Even if I gave it the state 0, sometimes it would report 1, and mostly would report 0. So this is just the combination of those two things. And the final state, row 0 prime, getting the final state given the measurement outcome 0 is 1 over p naught, that's the renormalization, and now we have q cos squared gamma 0, 0 plus 1 minus q sine squared gamma 1, 1. So the state has the same form as it originally did. It still is a convex mixture, a mixed state combining 0 and 1. But now the relative probabilities have changed. I can think of this measurement, the disturbance on this state, as just updating q to a new q prime. So this state has the form of q prime 0, 0 plus 1 minus q prime 1, 1, where we have just mapped q to q prime, which is given by now q cos squared gamma over p naught, which is q cos squared gamma plus 1 minus q sine squared gamma. And that I can simplify if I want to this form. Let's consider some special cases. Half maps to cos squared gamma. 0 maps to 0. 1 maps to 1. So we think of this, if I plotted this out, here's input q going from 0 to 1. Here's output q prime going from 0 to 1. For different values of gamma, it's just doesn't change at all if we do no measurement. If gamma equals zero, that means I've done a projective measurement. I know I collapse to the final state zero. So initially, I had some probability Q of being in a state zero, but if I do a projective measurement and get the outcome zero, now the state is definitely in a state zero. So that goes to probability one for any Q. And in between, you get sort of something that looks like maybe that or like that. Okay, where does that function come from? Well, this is sort of interesting and maybe not surprising. This original form, it's sort of hard to see in this form. But this form, I've said I had some initial state. I wasn't certain whether it's in a state 0 or 1. Had probability Q of being in a state 0. I've done a measurement on it, which told me a bit about whether it's in a state 0 or 1. It's given me some information. This Q prime, how I update that probability after the measurement, given that I learned a bit and I got the outcome zero, is exactly Bayes' rule. This is just Bayes' rule that takes, okay, I had some prior probability Q that it was in the zero state. I did a measurement. There's a probability for that measurement outcome given that state, that initial state. I apply Bayes' rule and I say, what's after measuring this system? What is the probability assignment I should give for it being in the zero state now, given that I was in the zero state before with probability Q, and I've learned a bit more in this measurement process? I update my information using Bayes' rule, and you can check, this is the new That is Bayes' rule when I use that probability for the measurement outcome. So that's very satisfying. You say, okay, well, my picture of that mixed state at the top being, might be in a state zero, might be in a state one, I have some uncertainty about which state it is. I assign a probability to that, which denotes my prior information about the system. I do a measurement, I learn something about the system, I've gained more information, I update my prior using Bayes' rule, and now describe the state using using that new information. So here, we've changed the state. I would say there's a measurement disturbance here. And then you'd be like, well, that's a bit odd to call that measurement disturbance. You've just learned something about the system and updated its state with Bayes' rule. Let's look at another example, which will really put that dichotomy right into the forefront. Let's take this system to be in a pure state. And I'm going to pick it to look a lot like a pure state version of that initial mixed state. So now I'm in a pure state where I have probability amplitude root Q for being in a zero state, probability amplitude root 1 minus Q for being in a 1 state, and I'm in a coherent superposition of those two terms. Now I would say, this is not, you know, a system of which I'm uncertain about. I have quantum uncertainty, obviously, but, you know, this is describing a spin in some direction. If Q was equal to a half, that would be a spin pointing in this direction. Let's apply this same process. Let's say we do outcome zero. You could do this all for outcome one as well. I have the exact same P naught. The resulting final state, I'll let you guys fill in the details, is still pure. There's a single measurement operator which acts on the state psi. It takes it to a new rank one state, unnormalized. So then we, okay, so writing it as a density operator. We then normalize it with P naught. And you can check that that psi prime is exactly 1 over root P naught root Q cos gamma 0 plus root 1 minus Q sine gamma 1. And that matches up exactly like these amplitudes, if I square them, are exactly these probabilities over here. So you say, OK, well, what's gone on here? Here's my block sphere. Here's 0 and 1. I put in some initial state that's a superposition state. Say I put in a state plus. Well, and I've written it on the wrong side, so right over here. Plus, which corresponds to Q equals a half, right? I do this measurement. There's some probability that I'll get the outcome 0. Let's say that occurred. What's the final post-measurement state? Well, it's moved up the surface of the block sphere, but it's still pure. Now it is some psi naught prime. And the amount it's moved up depends on the strength of the measurement. If there was no measurement, then it doesn't move. If it's a projective measurement, it moves straight up here to 0. When I get the outcome 0, I'm definitely now in a state 0. But I've done a weak measurement, then I'm just somewhere along this line. So now we think, OK, this is some disturbance of my spin due to measurement. I've got a spin. It's pointed in this direction. I'm measuring it in the z direction weakly. And I'm learning a bit about it. Say I get the outcome 0. Then the state, through that process of coupling to the meter, is disturbed and rotates up a bit. How much does it rotate? What's the strength of that disturbance? Oh, you use Bayes' rule. And you're like, what? The strength of the disturbance of the direction of the state is given by Bayes' rule? That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Here it was fine for me to think of Q as representing just some uncertainty I had about the initial preparation. I measured the system. I learned something about it. I wouldn't call that measurement disturbance. I just update my Q with Bayes' rule. That seemed fine to me. Here, I measure a system in a pure state. It does get disturbed. And you're like, oh, yeah, the von Neumann measurements. You couple it to the meter. It's going to get some back action on it. It's going to get kicked. What's the strength of that kick? That's also given by Bayes' rule. That seems like a very odd mix of describing what's happening to the system using how I've changed what I know about the system. And that, I think, should strike you as a mix of completely incongruent notions. That the amount we're disturbing this state in this measurement is given by something that is derived from Bayes' rule. I've learned something about the system, and the amount of kick I get is related to that. And then you say, well, maybe it's just all sort of has to be consistent in that way. There is a real physical disturbance, and then if I work through some consistency of, well, how do I relate the amount of that disturbance? Well, it relates to the amount of information I gain, and that, of course, relates to Bayes' rule. So maybe it's not surprising that there's a connection there. But it's just, I think, quite striking that the process we look at here is one where, through measurement, we're seeing a non-unitary dynamics. It's a partial wave function collapse. And that dynamics is given in part by elements that look like are updating our own knowledge of the system rather than properties of the system itself. So that should make you uncomfortable. And if it does, good. Let's look at another aspect of this uncomfortableness. Let me just flip back here, right back here for the moment. And again, think of this process of going from here to here. As I said, in the operator sum representation, in the idea of coupling system to the environment and then tracing over the environment, I would construct this completely positive trace preserving map, which updates accordingly. It's a convex combination of sort of the different possibilities in that operator sum representation. To think of it as a measurement, you don't trace out the environment, you measure that meter, and it gets to this one or this one. And I can really rewrite this state as a convex combination of this with the probability that it occurs, and this with the probability of it occurs. And so you say, well, okay, that makes sense. Really, a measurement happened here, and when I throw out that environment, I'm just forgetting what that measurement outcome is. But really what's going on is I can think of one of these outcomes occurring. That would be fine if it wasn't for the degree of freedom in the operator sum representation. The idea that we could, instead of saying is there an equivalence between throwing away the environment, tracing over the environment, and measuring in some basis and forgetting the outcome, let's make an equivalence between tracing over the environment and measuring in a different basis and see what we get. And that's where this this idea of the quantum eraser comes from. So there's a long history of coming up with cute names for things that are quantum phenomena. Quantum eraser is one that's sort of meant to strike the non-classicalness of the process to you. If you don't like the name, let's just ignore it, but it's a standard one. we can describe this idea of quantum eraser within this this framework of measurement of a qubit with another qubit that we've just described. Let's, in this case, choose chi equal to 0. So the meter state is 0. What does that mean? Remember, our weak measurement corresponded to picking in those parameters at the beginning, eta equal to 0 and chi equal to gamma. So gamma equals 0, that is chi equals 0. It's sort of like we're expecting to do a strong measurement here. But what we're going to vary is the basis in which we do the measurement on the meter system. So let's go through the same process again. Let's describe coupling to the measurement device. Again, with the C naught gate, this fixed unitary. Now we can be a bit more explicit if we start the system in a pure state and the meter in the state 0. Here we're going to induce perfect correlations. This is all set up for us to see how we can do projective measurement. An arbitrary pure state there, and 0 for the meter. The C naught couples that in such a way that they become perfectly correlated in this basis. So we have perfect correlation of the initial system state and the state of the measurement device in the 0-1 basis, the Z basis. So if we measure the meter now in the 0-1 basis, this corresponds to a projective measurement on the system. Yeah. Nothing surprising there. And if we said, let's look at this in our operator sum notation, and imagine that somehow we've now forgot the measurement outcome for the meter. Let's, instead of projecting in that basis, let's trace over M. It's completely consistent with measuring and then forgetting the outcome. You would get a resulting completely positive trace preserving map on the system given by M naught on S. With M, sub M is just projector for this strong measurement case onto the state 0, 1 for the system. So if I measure in the meter now in a 0, 1 basis, I've done a projective measurement on the system. I've collapsed it into either the state 0 or 1. If for some reason I forgot the measurement outcome, then I would say the system evolves into a stochastic mixture of the state 0 or 1 with probabilities given by those measurement outcomes. So, okay, I measured the system. It did collapse into 0 or 1, but I forgot which one. So I'd represent it as a mixed state, perfectly consistent. The idea of a quantum eraser is to illustrate the degree of freedom that comes in that choice of operator sum representation. Yes, I can interpret this as a convex combination of those two outcomes. It either projected into 0 with some probability or projected into 1 with some probability. But I can think of it in another decomposition that just corresponds to, imagine I measured the meter in a different basis. Let's measure it instead in the plus m minus m basis. What effect does that have on my system? So this is an easy calculation to do. There's the system meter state at the top, perfectly correlated in the 0, 1 basis. But now I measure the meter in the plus minus basis. What do I get? Well, I can check now that I get different operators for my operator sum representation. I'll call them E now, an E plus, which is given by I've measured the meter in the plus state. After applying U on the system meter and it initialized in the zero state, that turns out to be proportional to the identity operator on a system. The other outcome is proportional to the Pauli Z operator on the system. Not the identity, but a unitary rotation of the system about pi about the Z axis. So by the way, in the language of weak measurements, this corresponds to chi equals 0 and picking this eta equals pi on 4. In our von Neumann framework. So this is not a projector, but a unitary. OK, so let's just think about what that means. We've just used the degree of freedom in the operator sum representation. This CPTP map can be represented that way, or it could be represented instead with these operators. What's going on in these two pictures? In the one, I've done a projective measurement. I've collapsed the system either into the 0 or 1 state. And then if I forget the outcome, then I get a mixed state, which is an incoherent combination, a convex combination, a mixed state of being in the 0 state, being in the 1 state. And you say, I want to interpret it as, OK, well, you know, the system sort of was measured. It's either in 0 or 1. I just don't know which one. But a measurement really did take place. But it's completely equivalent to this process. That's the same completely quantum operation, same E, the same completely positive trace preserving map with these operators. What happened here? Well, it says if I got the outcome 0, I haven't collapsed the system at all. It's still in the same state. I have just the identity act on it. And if I get the one outcome, well, It hasn't collapsed or anything. It just got rotated by pi. The convex combination of those two things, taking a state with nothing happening to it, the same original state, and mixing it with the state rotated by pi, gives the same mixed state as some probability of being in the zero and some probability of being in the one. But to argue that, oh, here a measurement has occurred and I just forgot the outcome, I just don't know which one. Well, you're like, well, if a measurement occurred, it didn't collapse a state, you didn't learn anything about it, it just either let it pass right through undisturbed, or it rotated it in a unitary way, which hasn't removed any of its coherence. I could recover that if I knew that measurement outcome. So it would be wrong to say I'm going to assign, when I write out a CPTP map, considering just tracing over the environment, oh, I'm tracing over the environment, but really I can think of it as measuring in some basis, and the system's just been measured, and I just don't know which one. You can't say that, because it's this map is completely equivalent to saying, oh, well, the system maybe didn't have anything happen to it at all, or maybe it got rotated by pi, but there was no non-unitary dynamics, there was no wave function collapse there, the system was not measured in any way. Those are equivalent descriptions within quantum mechanics.
Well, that's if you lose, that's in the first case, if you lose the outcome of the measurement.
When you have the outcome, there's a specific non-convex linear map which tells you I get this one or this one for different choices of measurement operators. If you wanted to say, oh, I can recover it without having to assume anything about some non-linear process here, I want to describe all of my quantum measurements somehow within the quantum formalism, and to say that, oh, when I take this operation and write it as a convex combination, oh, it's just saying there's a couple of different measurement outcomes, and it's just a matter of me to like somehow pick out the right one. I'm just giving you a warning that you should not look at a convex combination of that form and say, well, let me just think of it as now it's one of these possibilities, and I measured a system by just picking one. Because there are alternative decompositions of that same process, which will lead you to a completely different description of the dynamics of the system, and maybe no measurement at all actually occurs.
So the only thing that we have, you know, for sure is the mixed state that we get at the end.
Yes.
The
operator sum formalism gives you is that mixed state at the end. If you want to have a measurement outcome, you need to go in to the unitary dynamics of quantum mechanics and do something nonlinear and say, I choose to have this outcome to occur or this outcome to occur with different probabilities. I have to insert an additional rule into quantum mechanics. We haven't solved the measurement problem. We've just pushed it out into a degree of freedom on this operator sum representation for describing the different states of the meter. Any questions with that? And just as a final thing, I'm not going to say a lot about Wigner's friend, but this is a nice argument that shows that not only should you be wary of doing that, picking out a preferred ensemble decomposition of a quantum operation and saying, here's what really happened, and these are the different possibilities. Not only is that, you know, a naughty thing to do, but you can actually derive contradictions between making the assumptions that there really is some outcome with some value, and I just don't know it, giving it a preferred decomposition. You can derive a contradiction between that and the rules of quantum mechanics in ways that look a lot like not a Bell inequality, but a proof of Bell non-locality by showing you can't posit the existence of predefined things. The basic idea of Wigner's friend is just that, now I can never remember who's Wigner and who's the friend in this scenario, but it's invariant. There's a system Vigner does a measurement on that system. Vigner is system M1, and we might describe in a, you know, a very simplistic language, evolving the system and some initial condition, initial state of Vigner and his measurement device into a correlated state, 0, 0, SM1 plus beta 1, 1, SM1. And that's all nice and unitary. And then you say, OK, I put in an additional measurement rule, and Vigner picks out one of the measurement outcomes or the other corresponding to his measurement result. I want to put that whole thing in a box and call that a new system, where Vigner's friend, who has walked out of the lab during this experiment, had some lunch, come back, and now the lab is there, and he's trying to figure out, has Vigner done that measurement that he was going to do or not? How should he describe this process? should he describe it as, well, let's take that state prior to Vigner having done the measurement. Maybe he hasn't collapsed the state yet. And let's put my state in a zero state and then go through the process again. Should I start with that in describing my measurement on what Vigner has done? Or should I say he actually has done the measurement? What's occurred is he's either got this outcome with probability alpha squared, and it's, or it's this outcome with probability beta squared. And I just don't know which. So that should be 1, 1. So which one should he use? And you can go through a an argument and derive a contradiction if you want to say that there is a consistent way for me to assign actual outcomes to when Vigner has done this measurement and say, and then have the person outside say, oh, it's some mixture of those two possibilities. I just don't know which, but there is definitely some element of reality that's describing what really occurred. You can then construct a contradiction with the predictions of quantum mechanics. And it's a bit sophisticated. We're not going to go through those details, but I'll give you a reference for a relatively recent paper, which explores this really nice. And it's quite a readable paper, and very also mathematically rigorous, if you like that. So it's on the archive. There it is down there.
So in which case choosing neither, we would get to a problem. That's the idea. We should choose the first option, the second option, or it's a problem to
yeah.
ask myself.
Yeah, sorry. So if you follow this and say, oh, it's just going to be unitary dynamics inside, you don't derive a contradiction, but you're not able to say Vigner did a measurement, that there was some measurement outcome. You have to, in a sense, say, well, it's still in a quantum state, and I can't assign values to what his outcome is that he would have got if he had measured it. So it's fine to describe everything unitarily, but then there's no measurement being done. So if I want to say Vigner did a measurement, he got an outcome, and then I want to use something like this, I want to pick out a preferred element that says, OK, there's the outcome that Vigner got that corresponds to, in a similar way, to signing a value to the spin in one half of a Bell experiment and saying it really did have a value before I measured it. You can, again, get yourself, you can prove a contradiction using a very similar line of argument.
So should you use the first one?
So we don't have a theory that allows you to say a measurement has gone on inside that box, and that I can describe what's going on from the perspective of Vigner's friend outside the box as like a von Neumann measurement procedure. Yeah?
So the question is, like, I have, for example, two particles which are in the Bell state. you either do something or you don't, and I don't know whether you did something or not. And then you give me the particles, and I should determine whether you did something or not. Right? That's the question. And you say that question is unsolved.
No. The question that's a different question. The one I want to solve is, can I consistently say that the person inside the box has done a measurement, that there is an outcome, that exists as some sort of element of reality, that they've got the outcome zero, that's what Wigner has measured, and make that consistent with the predictions I would get using this framework for someone who's describing the whole lab as a quantum system and saying it's governed by unitary dynamics. You can drive a contradiction between the assumption that there was a definite value, say zero, for what Wigner measured, and the perspective of Wigner friends saying, oh, I want to describe this using the von Neumann framework and use unitary evolution of the system with my measurement device and get the usual answer.
But if you're not describing Wigner but only the system, isn't it the same thing? So you're asking the question, is my system itself in a mixed state, or is it just coupled to Wigner? But if you're ignoring Wigner...
No, we're not ignoring Wigner. Sorry. So the person outside the lab is doing a measurement of the whole... Sorry, so I was unclear about the term system, but the person outside the lab is treating S prime as their system, including Wigner in it. That's the idea of Wigner's original argument, was that his friend should come back and treat the whole lab as his new system. Wigner's inside, but I'm going to treat him quantum mechanically. He's coupled to the measurement device, and I want to write him out using this language and then complete my von Neumann model for measuring whether the lab had that measurement done. And there's a contradiction between the outcomes of that and the assumption that Wigner has obtained a definite outcome to what he measured. That, in a sense, Wigner's friend now is just going to reveal at the end of the day.
But in the unitary view, Wigner did get a definite value. You just don't know which one. And that is described by a unitary interaction because, like, Wigner is just like considers himself inside one of the parts of the superposition. That's the whole many worlds thing.
If you want to say that one of those many worlds is definitely describing the system, then that's what will allow you to sort of go to the contradiction that there is a outcome that.
A measurement done by someone outside, because he's describing the entire system. You can't describe yourself.
Yeah. Okay. I mean,
the first one is just saying.
I mean, I'm perhaps being a bit sloppy here with what I mean by this. But what I mean is, Wigner's done the measurement on his measurement device, which like gives a definite outcome and now allows him to infer a definite value for the system. Okay, he wants to say I have got zero. Zero occurred, that there is something in the world that is the outcome zero.
And the first case, because Wigner can't actually tell me the result, because if he tells me the result, that's the measurement. That's me measuring my friend. In this case, the friend measuring Wigner. Like, Wigner and the friend can't just go ahead and talk.
So you're saying that Wigner's friend, I mean, I think this is might be the source of the problem is that Wigner's friend trying to describe a system where the measurement has occurred would not use this type of description. The Wigner's friend...
I'm saying that one of the friends doesn't measure something himself, it's the first case. The first case is like what happens when interactions happen. Like, it's just Wigner interacting with the system. But as long as you don't measure from outside, why would that collapse?
So you're arguing that, really the right way to do it is to treat Wigner and the system as being in that entangled, coherent state.
Yeah.
And What I'm saying is that can't be in the same way as Bell, that can't be made consistent with saying, oh, well, you know, from Wigner's perspective, he's a person, he says, I got an outcome, I did a measurement. There is, you know, the world is now described by this system being in the zero state, and it's not the one. The one did not occur, I got zero. That's the inconsistency. If you want to say that there's a value to what Wigner assigned, you're just saying, oh, I don't have to posit a value, that's fine. I'm saying you can't. So maybe we should take this offline. And I mean, this paper does sort of give a very clear exposition of this problem if you want some more details there. When did we start? Like an hour ago, right? Let me just set up the next topic. So my goal was actually to have got through that by last week, so we're running a bit behind schedule. That's fine. So this is a very much a transition part in this course, and it will seem very abrupt when I do it right in the middle of a lecture. I was hoping that transition would occur over the weekend when it makes a little more sense. What we've done now is really done a pretty thorough introduction to operational quantum mechanics. What I intended to do with the last week of this course was then look at some specific, you know, I guess you could say applications or some specific technical things in quantum mechanics that students in the past have expressed some interest in hearing about. And the first one that I wanted to cover is some aspect of perturbation theory. So most of you have seen perturbation theory in some form, is that right? Put up your hand if you've seen some perturbation theory. So that's what I expected. So we're not gonna do a standard treatment of perturbation theory. I'm actually gonna show you it's an old tool, but it's one that's suddenly become very commonly used in a range of problems across theoretical physics. So it's maybe not a very common formulation of perturbation theory in an undergraduate course, but nonetheless, I'm hoping that this is one where if you do a research project later this year, you're almost gonna sort of see some places where this might apply. This is a quite an active area of using perturbation theory for a bunch of modern problems. So it's a particular formulation, a particular type of perturbation theory, and I'm hoping even for you, those of you who've studied a fair bit of perturbation theory, that this will be very complementary. It's going to be very different techniques. But those of you who haven't seen so much perturbation theory, that's fine. This will all be fairly self-contained. Okay. So I'll give you a reference for this particular flavor of perturbation theory, which is called Schrieffer-Wolf. Is a great sort of quite modern and rigorous treatment of this by Bravi, DiVincenzo, and Loss, which is on the archive as well. And they give all the gory details. It's very rigorously presented. But also, I think it's also quite a pedagogical paper. So it's very approachable. It's a big subject. And I'm only going to, you know, introduce it and give you the general idea. You can go to there for more of the technical details if you decide you do want to use it. So this is a flavor of perturbation theory that applies to a particular class of problems that emerges in quantum many-body physics. So let me sort of set up what is the class of problems that we're looking at. And the idea is really trying to construct low-energy effective theories for some phenomena. We have a very complicated theory with an enormous space of states. Not all of them, those states, are perhaps relevant for what's going on in describing the low-energy properties. So quite often we're interested in deriving effective theories which describe the system when it's at low energy or low temperature. And we want to have a nice formal framework for taking our complicated theory and constructing nice low energy effective theories. So that's part of the broader research question. And of course, that's done in things from string theory to condensed matter physics to quantum information and beyond. So let's take a quantum many-body system. By the way, so the origin of this technique is really from the condensed matter community. This is most naturally sort of introduced. It's not limited in its applicability, but it's most naturally introduced by considering a finite but large number of finite dimensional quantum systems, so like a spin lattice or something like that, and taking the number of spins to be large, going to thermodynamic limits and so on. But nonetheless, we're talking about a spin lattice and not maybe a field theory. Okay, so a general feature of a lot of quantum many-body systems that we're interested in physics is that it has a spectrum that has some properties such as this. There's a ground state, possibly degenerate, possibly not degenerate. There's maybe a bunch of low energy states. There are high energy states. And what separates low from high? For a lot of problems in interest, it's not by any means guaranteed, but if there is some sort of spectral gap, which is an energy scale that separates the low energy physics from the high energy physics, then that's going to be the class of models that we're going to be interested in describing. Okay. So you know, up there, high energy states may be physics at the Planck scale that you don't care about. Or you could be trying to describe the properties of a bunch of interacting particles, but not worry about the high energy states that come about from additional pair creation of those particles, because maybe that's very well separated by some energy cost to creating more particles. So these states are relevant to the low energy physics. Where these, you might hope, are not relevant, or at least not very relevant in some sense that we hope to make. Okay, so this is a very standard example. This ground state, so let me just sort of enumerate some sort of very so recent areas that have made this technique quite now commonly used, is that in the problem we're going to look at with Schrieffer-Wolf, this ground state could be degenerate or have low energy states which are sort of exponentially close in the size of the system to that ground state. Extremely small energy. This is the type of thing that arises in models that have some topological degree of freedom. So those are used a lot in quantum information for quantum codes. They're used a lot in, it's all the rage now in condensed matter physics, understanding topological systems. In a sense, the definition in condensed matter physics is that there is a ground state degeneracy that depends on the topology of that system. And of course, they have their origin in string theory, going back a number of decades. So the system we have in mind is one that could be exactly degenerate, or perhaps near degenerate. So it could be have a low energy space, all very close in energy with respect to this spectral gap. So we call such systems degenerate. And often, then, the language you'd use that for the type of perturbation theory, the flavor of perturbation theory that we're going to develop here, is degenerate perturbation theory. It's meant to work on systems where that spectrum has some degeneracies, or at least some very near degeneracies, and a quite clear separation now in terms of these energy scales. Okay, so that's just, you know, the broadest and simple, very simplistic perspective on what is the idea of low energy effective theories. What are we going to try to do with perturbation theory in understanding low energy physics in these theories? Well, here's the hope. That we have some complex model with such a spectrum. There's some spectral gap. There's a low energy space, which I can define by, well, a space or a projector onto that space. Sorry, I don't want to call it P naught. That's supposed to be P. And what I would hope to do is to say, sorry, yes?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm a bit confused with the definition of this spectral gap.
Sorry?
I'm a bit confused with the definition of this spectral gap.
Yeah, OK, I'll give you, right now I'm trying to paint a picture. I'll give you some precise definitions shortly. Yeah, but right now let's just set up the picture, and then we'll get rigorous. What I want to do is take this a complex model where I can't solve it. I perhaps can't figure out even exactly what that spectrum is or how to express those states. And certainly it's all jumbled up with these higher energy states. Even if it looks like a simple model, it's not making a clear separation between the excited states and ground states in the way I'm expressing it simply. And so I get quite confused. And so what I'm hoping to do with degenerate perturbation theory is to take some simple model with a very similar type of spectrum, described by some P naught. So these things are projectors onto low energy subspaces for the two models. And this is also going to be gapped. This model has some Hamiltonian, which I have trouble solving directly for the low energy physics. This model over here has some easy Hamiltonian, simple to solve for that low energy physics, easy to identify what are those low energy states, what forms do they take. I want to be able to write my complicated model in terms of a simple one with some perturbation. Immediately, I can sort of see that I'm going to have to, if I want a unitary, which is going to relate these two models, that takes the low energy physics of this model and maps it to the to a low energy physics model on this simple to solve one. I want to have, okay, so this is easy to solve. I want to, and then I want to say this whole thing is hard to solve. I want to construct an H effective model on P naught, on the ground state space of this simple model, where I can think of taking this hard to solve model expressed in this form, acting on it with some unitary, and restricting it to this subspace B naught, And I want to find a nice systematic way of expressing out what is this effective Hamiltonian over here in terms of, you know, the known solution to H naught, and as a Taylor series in this perturbation parameter epsilon. So in that sense, it's perturbation theory as you know it. What Schrieffer-Wolf does as an approach to this problem is to say, okay, well, if we put some bound on the size of this perturbation, such that, okay, well, the states move around and change their form and so on, but we're still basically going to maintain the properties of this spectral gap in as shown in this picture, and we're going to define that more rigorously, then I can think of, yes, there's going to be some unitary, which goes from here to here, which is going to have a specific action on taking the ground space of this and sort of mapping it, sorry, not the ground space, but the low energy subspace of this and mapping it to the low energy subspace of this. And that these things are sort of comparable size because the perturbation is not large enough to move what were low energy states out into the high energy part of the spectrum and vice versa. It's going to keep that sort of separation of energy scales as given by that gap. So there's the hope of what we can do with Schrieffer-Wolf, is to find a unitary taking here to here and to have an expansion for the generator of that unitary as a Taylor series in epsilon, and to be careful about the convergence of all of those terms so that we can pick an order in perturbation theory and be able to say with confidence properties of the effective Hamiltonian that we get in P naught that's approximating the low energy physics over here on this complicated system up to some order. So that's going to be the central approach of Schrieffer-Wolf, developing what is that unitary thought of as being generated by some operator, and to have a way of constructing a systematic Taylor series for what that operator is, and to figure out what that Taylor series looks like in terms of the various properties of the spectrum of H naught, and how operators in V act on that spectrum. So that's what we're going to try to do. We'll get started on that in earnest tomorrow. The first thing we're going to do is introduce some nice mathematical tools for properties of this unitary, which nicely map one subspace to another. The first thing you want to do is to map this low energy subspace from P to P naught in a systematic way. We're going to develop some general algebraic tools for doing that. That forms the basic framework for Schrieffer-Wolf. And then we'll give this sort of general approach to the Schrieffer-Wolf solution, and we'll outline at least how that that perturbation expansion goes. Any questions with that? Has anybody used Schrieffer-Wolf before?
So why would you use that over regular perturbation? What's the advantage?
The main advantage is that this works when you have these strict ground state degeneracies. The other nice thing about this approach is that there is a systematic way to take a model which is local and to make sure that the resulting effective Hamiltonian over on this space is also local. So that's something that if you try to look at other general approaches to degenerate perturbation theory, that they would fail at doing. So a lot of them can't handle that exact ground state degeneracy, and even the ones who can. that the range of the terms in a Hamiltonian here have some finite spatial support, and you want to make sure that I can express my effective Hamiltonian as a whole bunch of sum of terms that are interacting and have some finite spatial support. Okay, so this originates in condensed matter theory. It was used originally to help find a solution to the Kondo problem. But as I said, it's now quite broadly used across theoretical physics. So we'll go through the details of that tomorrow in what I hope will be a fairly self-contained introduction. See you then.